Yes. My name is Hope Couch. I'm 21 years old. The date is March 20th, 2019, and I'm sitting with my dad, Eamon Couch, in our living room in Corbin, Kentucky. My first question for you today, Dad, is when and where were you born?
I was born on September the 5th, 1969, in Hyden, Kentucky, at the Mary Breckinridge Hospital.
So where did you grow up?
I grew up in rural southeastern Kentucky, in northeast Clay County, a little community called Panko, just a very small little community of families and homes there, way back in the hills.
Wait, what's the road called that you lived on?
Bullskin is the name of the creek. The highway's 1482, the creek itself, we lived on Bullskin Creek, but the little community was called Panko.
Oh, okay. What was it like?
A lot of the homes that were around me, most of them had young kids my age. Everybody was really, really close. Everyone pretty much that lived there had grown up there generationally. You had multiple generations of people that had lived there and grown up there, lived and even were buried there. So it was truly a very small knit community of families. It was really fun, very family friendly. Not a lot of drugs. Back in those days, not a lot of foolishness. Most people worked jobs and people were happy and went to church, and it was just a really fun growing up. I felt very safe growing up. There wasn't a lot of issues about kids getting abducted and that kind of thing. I mean, you could go out in the mornings and hang out with your friends and ride bikes and play in the creek and mess around the woods and that kind of thing. And it's what we did.
Yeah. Who were your parents?
Well, I was raised by my grandparents. My mother wasn't married when she gave birth to me, and she gave me to my grandparents, who adopted me. So I grew up with my grandparents as my mom and dad, which was great. And their names was Eamon and Eva Couch.
And what were they like?
They were kind of larger than life people. My father was a World War II veteran. He fought in Europe during World War II under General Patton. And I was very proud of him and still am today. He was the greatest man I ever knew. And I was named after him, which I didn't really realize the significance of that until I became an adult. My mother and both of them only went to the eighth grade. That's as far as they went, but they were the two of the wisest people I've ever known in my life. My mother was a stay-at-home mom. She was there to take care of the house and make sure that we had food and our clean clothes and make sure the house was clean. And she ran the house. My dad was a coal miner, worked for probably 20 years in the coal mines. Growing up too, they also owned a little country store that we would shop from, and a lot of dad's friends would come there and hang out in the evenings and whatnot. But he would work in the mines during the day and then come home in the evenings and run the store. Mom would run the store during the day, but then when dad retired, then he ran the store full time. They were wonderful, wonderful parents. I was very blessed to have good parents who loved me and took care of me.
That reminded me, what was that one story about the storehouse that everyone talks about, everyone tells?
Yeah, the holdup. Yeah.
Yeah.
This was before I was born, so all of my knowledge of it is secondhand, but this was in the late 60s, actually in the early 60s, probably 1963, I think is when it took place. Keep in mind, this is a very isolated little community. And one morning before school, my real mother, her sister, really the whole family was down at the storehouse, and they were getting ready to walk. Their school was walking distance from the house. And it was probably 7 o'clock in the morning, and a car pulled in. It was a strange car. And of course, in those days, everyone knew everyone's cars, and this one wasn't one that they knew. And a young man walked in. He was around 18 years old. he was not someone that they knew at all. He was a stranger. That's just really odd to on Bullskin in Panko in 1963 for this strange 18-year-old kid to walk in the store. And my dad waited on him, and dad had a barrel there with apples in it. And the young man asked my father, keep in mind he had not been, he had been in World War II not that long before, probably 10 years before, 15 years before. So he was a very big, strong man. And this guy wanted to buy some apples. And he asked my father how much they cost. And I think dad said there were 3 for a quarter or something like that. And dad got the apples, and the guy said, my father said, we put them in a bag for me. And dad said, sure. And so he leaned under the counter to get a paper bag to put the apples in. And when he raised up, the guy had a 38 special, a pistol pointed right in my dad's face. And my dad started moving toward him. And keep in mind, the store's full of people, his children, his wife, his sister. It was a full house. It's not a big store building either.
No.
And big crowd. And there was a wood stove right in the middle of the floor. And the guy says, if you move 1 inch more toward me, I'm going to kill you. I'm going to shoot you. And dad, he just didn't know fear. And so he kept moving toward him. Dad always said it was my goal to try. My dad had huge hands. And so my dad said his goal was always to, because the hammer was pulled back on the gun.
Yeah.
So all the guy had to do was pull the trigger. Yeah. And dad said, if I could get my thumb between the pistol and the hammer, I could block it. I could block the gun from firing.
Yeah.
So he went for it. And it went off. The gun shot. And it fired. It was pointed. And so they began to struggle. But dad looked to see if anybody fell, like, because he shot in my mom's direction, and she did not fall.
Mm-hmm.
And dad proceeded to disarm him and get on top of him. And my mother was screaming the whole time, kill him, shoot him. And dad said he felt the trigger pull underneath his finger, and he stopped before it went too far. Well, they arrested the guy, and kind of the rest is history. In fact, my dad, when it was all said and done, got to keep that pistol, and we have that pistol here in the house.
Yeah, I was about to say, we have that still. It's in good condition.
Mm-hmm. So, it's one of my most prized possessions.
Yeah. How, this is another good question, how was your relationship with your parents?
Well, growing up, I knew more than they did. I was a sort of a sarcastic, back-talking kid. I really felt like I was smarter than they were. And what a joke.
Yeah.
Keep in mind, I was raised by older people. They were in their 40s when they adopted me. So it'd be kind of like your mom and I now having a baby to raise, how hard that would be.
Mm-hmm.
But they were, what I found during my life is they did more with me, fun things with me, than all of my friends' parents who were 20 years younger than them.
Mm-hmm.
We would go out driving around together. My mom and I would hike in the woods together. My dad and I would sit in the evenings and talk, and he would come out of the garden with fresh cucumbers and apples, and he'd peel them, and we'd sit around and eat them and talk about the day. And I really enjoyed spending time with them. They were wonderful. And the older I got, the smarter they became.
Mm-hmm.
And that really wasn't them, it was me.
Yeah.
I became more aware of the fact how little I actually knew and how smart they really were.
Mm-hmm.
And the wisdom that they gave me was rich and a blessing. And I had fun parents. I just did. I had fun mm-hmm. parents. They were creative and fun.
Mm-hmm.
Dad worked all the time. So mm-hmm. when he would get home in the evenings, he would take a bath because he was all black from the coal mines.
Mm-hmm.
In the summertime, he would take a bath in the creek.
Really?
Yeah.
I didn't know that.
He did, because he would come in nasty.
Yeah.
And so mom would send him to the creek with a bar of soap, and he would get in. Mm-hmm. There's a deep part of the water down there.
Yeah.
It was like up to his waist.
Yeah.
And he would bath and wash himself in the creek
mm-hmm.
and clean himself up, and he'd come to the house. The wintertime, though, he would have to bath in the bathtub. We didn't have a shower.
Yeah.
We only had a tub.
Yeah.
So growing up, and the bathroom was painted pink. That was before your day and time. That bathroom was completely pink.
I didn't know
that. I don't understand why. It was a weird color, but it was pink. But we just had that bathtub, and people would come hang out at the house in the evenings. My mom's brother and friends would come, and my dad was a storyteller. He just loved to tell stories, and he would sit there with his friends and talk about old days and the war, and I just had a really, really good relationship with my parents.
Mm-hmm. So, did you ever get into any trouble?
I was a rule follower, pretty much. I did what was expected of me. That doesn't mean to say that I, at times, didn't. At times, I wasn't where I was supposed to be when I was supposed to be there. But we had a curfew. I had a curfew. And keep in mind, it was 45 minutes. Like, if I want to go to town, it was 45-minute drive
to get to
anywhere. So mm-hmm. we had a lot of activities at our local church. They had a gym down there. And I didn't really do a lot of things wrong. I pretty much, if I told my mom I would do something, I would mm-hmm. do that. I did get in trouble one probably the worst trouble I ever got in was when I was probably 11. He really wasn't a friend. He was one of my acquaintance. He was older than me. He was 16, 17. And I rode a long distance from home on my bicycle, unbeknownst to my mother. In fact, I ended up 11 miles from home.
On the bicycle.
And my neighbor saw me there and went and told my mother. My mother said, yeah, I thought he went down this road with Tony, and but he'll be back in a little while. And the neighbor said, no, he's way far from home.
Yeah.
Way far. So she sent my father to get me. And I was so tired. I'd ridden 11 miles from home. When we got into Oneida, that was the little town that we went to, I wanted to go home. I was scared and tired. And I said, Tony, can we go home? And he was like, I'm with my friends. You're on your own. So I just headed back home. And I got in a lot of trouble for that. A lot of trouble. But pretty much, I didn't get in a lot of trouble. I did whatever was expected of me, I tried to do.
Yeah, I'm sorry, but you were a pretty, like, mischievous kid.
Oh, yeah.
Like, setting off, what was it? Like, you would set off, like, bombs, and, like, not bombs, but, like, little explosives.
Cigarette loads. My dad smoked cigarettes, and I wanted him to quit. And I love playing practical jokes on my dad, and he would do stuff to me too. So it was kind of a two-way street. But back in those days, have you ever seen a cigarette load?
No.
They're these little pieces. They look like a piece of rice.
Oh.
And they're skinny, and you could slide them into a cigarette. So what you would do is I would take the cigarette load, and I would stick it in the end of the cigarette, and then I would get a straight pin, mm-hmm. and I would push it back into the cigarette, so it was deep in the cigarette. Mm-hmm. So dad would light it. And he'd smoke for a while, and then when it would heat up, it would explode. It would blow the end off the cigarette. Yeah, the whole cigarette would just explode. And he got so mad. And so dad never whipped me. My mother whipped me a lot.
Yeah.
She would whip you with whatever she could find. Fly swat, wooden spoon, spatula, hairbrush, whatever she could find to hit you with, she'd hit you. But dad never did. That was the closest he ever came to whipping me. Because he said, stop doing that. That scares me to death. And so I said, okay, Dad, I swear to goodness, I'll quit. I'm done. And I really did. I was like, I'm finished. But I forgot there was one more cigarette load in one of the cigarettes. Mm-hmm. And like 3 days later, we were driving down the road. Mm-hmm. He was driving. Mm-hmm. And it exploded again.
While you were driving.
While he was driving.
Yeah, while he was driving.
I thought he was going to wreck and kill me and him both. But he got so mad. He cussed and... And it was bad. It was bad. But I quit. I was like, I'm done, Dad. I'm done. No more. Period. I'm finished. And I never did that again.
Yeah. I don't blame you.
I went over the top.
Yeah. Do you have... Well, this is a weird question. Okay. But I know that this could open up a bucket of worms. But do you have any siblings? And what were they like growing up? That's a bucket of worms.
I technically have no siblings.
Legally.
When it comes to pure, okay. pure whole siblings, where we have the same mom and the same dad.
Right.
Zero.
Zero.
I'm the only child.
Yeah.
But I was adopted by my grandparents. So my mother's legally my sister.
Yeah, right.
And her sister, who's biologically my aunt, is legally my sister.
Right.
And their first cousin, my grandfather's daughter, or my grandfather's brother's daughter, is not, she's just a cousin, but yet I call her my sister too. When his name was Cecil. Cecil was my dad's brother, and he was killed. He was drunk and was climbing an apple tree and fell out and broke his back and died right there on the ground. And he told my father on his deathbed, literally as he was laying there dying, take care of Ruby, raise her like she's your own. So he raised his brother's daughter mm-hmm. as his own.
Yeah.
They got custody of her from the mother, mm-hmm. which is unusual, very strange. But so I call her my sister. So I have Patty, who's my real mother, who's my sister. I have Glenna, my aunt, who's my sister. And I have my, I don't know what she is, second cousin or something, who I consider my sister. Then my real father that I never knew, he died when I was 5 years old. Me and my mother was not married. I have found out that I have 3 half-siblings that live down in Tennessee and that we all have the same father. In fact, the third one, my second sister, we only found out about her this week.
Yeah, true.
This week. Brand new, right out of the package. She's 60, and her name's Christy, and then I have a brother named Jeff who's 53, and then I have a sister Robin who's 51, mm-hmm. I think, and then I'm 49. So I have 3 half siblings that I know of, maybe more. No, I have another one.
Yeah, you have 4.
I have Lisa.
I have 4
half siblings from my father, and that's it. Very unusual family tree. Very weird. It makes probably a really good movie. But yeah, that's it.
I wish we could draw it out on this app,
you
but we can't.
It. You can't do it. It's too complicated. It would look like some weird molecule.
What did you look like as a kid or maybe a teenager?
I was a skinny little kind of malnourished looking kid. Most of my growing up had a lot of hair, curly red hair. Pale skin, little skinny kid. When I had my tonsils taken out in 6th grade, I kind of began to gain weight after that. And I began, so pretty much my entire middle school and high school years, I was just a pudgy, kind of overweight, geeky kid.
Yeah.
Wouldn't have made any cover of any magazine or anything. I was not that. Never had any girlfriends in high school, never dated anybody. We didn't have any money, and I just wasn't that, I wasn't a good catch, I guess you would say, in those days.
I don't know, you look like looking at old pictures of you, you kind of look like a Tom Hanks.
I was socially awkward and not athletic. The only thing I had going for me was I was good in school. Mm-hmm. I loved school, I loved to learn. I was in the gifted program in high school, which I got to meet. I was the only kid from my elementary school that made it into that program. So I got to meet kids from all over the county, and those became my really good friends in high school. But yeah, I was just like I said, till probably 6th grade, I was just a skinny little kid, and then I became a pudgy kid and dealt with that the rest of my life.
That was Josh. No. So, let me see. How would you describe a perfect day when you were young?
Well, when I was a kid, I would get up in the mornings. I was not a late sleeper. I was up probably 7, 8 o'clock in the morning, and Mom would fix me breakfast. And sometimes my dad cooked breakfast. On days my mom didn't feel good, my dad always cooked breakfast. He would always, even on mornings when I would have oatmeal or cereal, my dad would always make him some eggs and bacon, mm-hmm. and he would fix gravy. Dad was a good gravy maker, and biscuits, mm-hmm. and we'd eat together, and then Dad would go to work. Now, after Dad retired, then Dad never came in the house. Dad was always outside. Mm-hmm. When he drank his coffee, ate him some cereal in the mornings, or maybe some biscuits and gravy or something, then he was outside in the garden working outside the entire day. He would come in at about 11 o'clock and watch Price is Right, watch the news, figure out what the weather was going to be, because you had to know what the weather was going to be.
Yeah.
Okay. Then he was out again. Mm-hmm. And he was out in the garden all day long until nighttime. He would come in about supper time. Mom would always have supper cooked. Mm-hmm. And then we would eat. And then I was out. I would go out in the mornings, I would get on my bicycle, and I would hit the road.
Mm-hmm.
And within about a half mile radius of the house, I could go anywhere I wanted to go. Anywhere I wanted to go. So if we happened to be at my friend's house at lunchtime, their moms would fix us lunch.
Yeah.
If we happened to be at my house at lunchtime, mm-hmm. my mom would cook lunch for us. Bologna sandwiches or ham yeah. sandwiches or something like that. And then, now when we got started getting into dirt bike stuff and four-wheeler stuff, everything changed. It got more complicated. We had more of a, I was older then though.
Yeah.
But I had a dirt bike when I was probably 10 years old, and then I had bicycles, and we down at the gym, we would hit, they had basketball games and softball games at night, and we were just out and about. So that was a good day. That was yeah. a good day, just playing outside, hanging out. There wasn't a lot of, like today, kids stay inside all the time, play video games and whatnot. Yeah. We didn't have that.
Yeah.
We didn't have that luxury. So we'd just be out. I had a basketball court there below the road.
Mm-hmm.
And we would have just big, epic basketball tournaments and games there in the evenings. And mm-hmm. We just had a blast. It was yeah. so much fun. And you're all time moving and doing things. And then the evenings, that's my most fun time. Because that's when Dad would, he'd be cleaned up from work.
Mm-hmm.
And we'd sit around and just sit on the front porch. Dad would be smoking a cigarette. And we'd just be sitting around talking about life and about, you know,
yeah.
stuff. And then in the evenings, family, back in those days, in the evenings, families would visit each other.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so my Uncle Manon and my Aunt Juanita would come over, we'd sit around in the living room, and my mom and Juanita would talk about girl things, and my dad and my Uncle Manon would talk about World War II, and
mm-hmm.
my Uncle Manon was in North Africa.
Mm-hmm.
My dad was in Europe, and they just talk about things, and I just sat there and just listen, just soak it up. And I think that's why I became a history teacher,
right?
Is because I learned from men who had given. That's why I love our country so much, is because I heard my dad. Well, my dad, who was a hard person in terms of emotions, but he always told me he loved me. I saw my dad shed tears. He didn't care to do that, but. Whenever my dad ever heard the national anthem play, he would always cry,
mm-hmm.
because he almost lost his life.
Right.
And so that's why I'm so passionate about this country, is because I saw him give so much for it. So
mm-hmm.
hope I answered that question.
No, you did. You did. What did you think your life would be like when you were older? What were your plans?
I didn't really know. Everybody said I was smart. I was on the academic team. I was a governor scholar, which that was a big deal.
Yeah.
For a 16-year-old me to go to Center College and spend the summer
right.
with kids who had ACT scores that were 30s. 30. I actually met a kid one time with a perfect ACT score. His name was Bob Carrico. Still remember his name. The weirdest kid I ever knew. But I knew that I was going to do something big. I really felt like I had something that I could do to make a difference in the lives of other people.
Mm-hmm.
I remember telling my high school gifted teacher I want to be a teacher. And she said, honestly, she said, you're too smart. I said, seriously, you're telling me that you can be too smart to be a teacher? Isn't that exactly who you want teaching your children, is a smart person? So I thought that was a little bit ironic.
Yeah.
But I thought about being an attorney. I thought I'd maybe like to be an attorney. There was this sort of infamous attorney that lived in Clay County during my growing up. He was very charismatic, very smart. He was like the smartest kid to come out of Bullskin.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not saying I'm the smartest guy to come out of Bullskin. I'm not saying that. But people are like, you know what? You're probably the smartest kid since him to come out of here. You should be a lawyer. I went, but I saw that all the lawyers that I knew were kind of shady.
Yeah.
And I thought, I can't do that and be ethical.
Mm-hmm.
That was my perception.
Yeah.
So I went to college on scholarships, didn't pay anything to go to college. And your mother and I decided that we wanted to be PhDs. We wanted to get our PhDs in history. We wanted to be professors. We wanted to come into Cumberland and teach there in our alma mater, have our offices in the same suite of offices, and teach and live down in Williamsburg until we died.
Mm-hmm.
But that never happened because the expense was just too large. they were going for the first. This was in 1991. UK was going to give us $30,000, loan us $30,000 for the first year of our master's program and PhD program, and it would have taken us 4 or 5 years to get it done. That would have been $150,000 of debt, and Cumberland at the time was paying about $30,000 a piece. Was paying about $30,000 for professors. Mm-hmm. I'm like, it would take us 1,000 years to pay off this debt.
Right.
We'll never pay it off. So we decided to go back and get our K-12 teaching degrees, which we were really close to doing that. And then we became high school English teachers.
So glad.
Yeah.
So glad. Do you have any favorite stories from your childhood? I can think of a few right now that you've told me in the past.
What can you think of? There's so many.
The four-wheelers.
Yeah, there was probably a half a dozen of us that were really good friends. And we would, on weekends, we would, I really don't know why my mother let me do this, but I would literally leave on Friday evenings and not come back till Sunday. We would just live in the woods all weekend long. Yeah. And we'd take our food. Mm-hmm. And we would sleep on our four-wheelers, or we would take our sleeping bags, and we'd just camp out and that kind of thing. Well, one of the guys that was in our group, he came from a little bit poorer family than us. He didn't have a four-wheeler, but he would go with us.
That's saying something.
Yeah, so we'd have room on the back of our four-wheelers. Four-wheelers are really one-person vehicles.
Well, yeah.
Okay, but we'd pile two or three on.
Yeah.
So Michael was one of this guy's names. Michael decided one weekend he was going to go with us, and so we said, sure, Michael. And Michael had a 10-speed bicycle. So we would go four-wheel on the top of this ridge way back in the hills, and there was a fire road, gravel road, and this road was probably 10 miles long. Mm-hmm. And keep in mind, you're on the top of this mountain ridge, and we would go up there, and we would camp out, and we'd ride four-wheelers all night long.
Mm-hmm.
It's one we didn't get killed.
Right.
It really is. It's one of it. No helmets. Nobody had helmets.
No lights.
We had headlights.
Okay,
good. We had headlights. Well, one night, Michael decided he wanted to go riding with us. Well, he had his 10-speed bicycle. We had strapped his bicycle onto the back of the four-wheeler and taken it up there with us. I don't know why we did that, but we did. And so one night, we decided to go riding, and there was all of us were together, and Michael said, I want to go with you guys out riding. And we're like, well, Michael, do you want to ride with us? Do you want to? He said, I'll bring my bicycle. And I'm like, well, there's no way you can keep up with ATVs on a bicycle.
Yeah.
And Michael said, you can pull me. Pull, you want me to pull you? And he goes, yeah. You just tie that yellow nylon rope, that really strong yellow nylon rope. So we tied one end around the back racks of my four-wheeler. Super tight, super secure. And so I went over to his bicycle with the other end of the rope. And I was going to tie the rope around the front forks of his bicycle. And he said, no, don't do that. He said, it's not as good. He said, you need to go ahead and wrap the rope around my chest, under my arms. And so I did that. So I wrapped the rope around his waist, tied it really tight, and we took off riding. And I was pulling him down this gravel road really fast, really fast. And we were around this curve one time, And it was dark. It was like in the middle of the night. Mm-hmm. And we were flying, there's dust flying up. And I turn around and look, and all I could see was the yellow rope tied into the fog, into the dust. And he was back there somewhere, riding and surviving. And I don't know how he was doing it, but he did. One time I was coming around a curve, and I still to this day do not know how this happened, but he gained on me in the curve. I think he like slingshotted around me. Because I turned around and looked, and he was gone. And I turned to the side, and he was right next to me. He had somehow gained momentum in the curve and slingshot around me. And remember, he's still tied to me. And he looks at me like, he wore glasses. I saw total fear, like I'm dying right now. And he hit something, hit a log. And I drug him probably 100 feet. Before I could get the four-wheeler stopped, and he never got a scratch on him. He was immortal.
He really was.
He was immortal, and there was 1,000 stories about Michael, but
falling out of
those
trees.
Are some of the falling out of trees, seeing snakes, just. But Michael was our friend, And he still is my friend. You've seen him at places. Yeah. I've introduced you to him.
Yeah.
He works at Frisch's up in London.
Yeah, he's a cool guy.
Yeah.
He's nice.
He's an odd dude.
He is odd.
But immortal.
He truly immortal. So now just going a little bit more towards me and my sister. How did you choose my name?
Two things. We like the sound of hope. I have taught a lot of kids over the years. And there was a young African-American student that I had right about the time you were born. Her name was Hope. Mm-hmm. And you don't find a lot of kids named Hope.
No.
There just aren't many. Now, in your grade, there was like three of you?
Yeah, there's like three Hopes.
It was unusual. It's not a normal name. So no, we love the sound of Hope. We like it was one syllable. Your mother and I, being English teachers, the sound of names, the flow of names means something. So we like, because we knew that Elizabeth was going to be your middle name after my father's mother.
Mm-hmm.
Her name was Elizabeth Couch. And we like, you don't want to have a first and middle name that are both multi-syllables.
Right.
So we decided Elizabeth is four syllables, right? Elizabeth.
Yeah.
Four syllables. Hope. With Elizabeth sounds, it flows well.
Mm-hmm.
Hope, Elizabeth, Couch. One syllable. One syllable, three syllables, one syllable. So your name, the sound of hope, just mm-hmm. because, and honestly, when we say your name, we wanted your name to be something that you could always remember, that life is full of hope.
Mm-hmm.
And regardless of how bad things get, there's always good in things. Mm-hmm. And you can find good things everywhere you look.
Mm-hmm.
So it has meaning.
Right.
And it's named after you. And then you're named after your grandmother, who was one of the strongest women.
Mm-hmm.
I never knew her. She died before I was born.
Mm-hmm.
But she was one of the strongest women that in our family that's ever been.
Mm-hmm.
And then your sister, she's named Cassandra, which is Cassie's what we call her. But my mother's mother was named Cassie. And then your sister's middle name is your grandmother, Chambers, Judy. Her middle name is Kay. So it's Cassandra Kay after Grandma Cassie and then Grandma Judy.
Mm-hmm.
And so names mean a lot.
They do.
And we want to be sure that we didn't, like for example, Jacob. We would never name, if we had a son, we'd never name him Jacob. Because Jacob means deceiver. So names mean something.
They do.
Cassandra means courage.
Yeah.
Hope means, obviously, hope.
Right.
We were not going to name. And there are certain kids that we've had over the years. Like, I had a kid named Brett years ago. Brett was absolutely the worst, probably the worst kid I ever taught. I would never name a son. If I had a son, I would never name a son Brett.
Because of that.
I would think about him.
Yeah.
So there's certain names that are completely off limits.
Right.
You know, I had a kid named Brad, too. I would never name a child Brad. Because he about drove me nuts.
Yeah.
You know. Your mom and I were very careful and very methodical and strategic about what we named you.
Right. Another good question. How did you meet mom?
Well, your mom and I were friends. We had classes together. We both had the same majors. We literally, the first class that we ever had in college was on a Thursday morning in mid-August 1987. World history class, 8 o'clock in the morning. Eric Wake, northeast corner classroom, second floor, second row. Your mom sat in the front seat, I sat in the back seat of the same row. That's how we met.
Mom's laughing.
She was very smart. She was so smart. I did well, but your mother was very intelligent, very smart. And I just liked her. She was smart and she was funny, and we had all these classes together. Mm-hmm. All these classes together. And I just got to know her. I liked her. She was a good friend. And then she was dating somebody. I was dating somebody else. And we broke up with our boyfriend and girlfriend. And we started dating. And then got married about 3 months after graduating from college. Yeah. So your mom and I were really good friends way long before we ever started dating.
Right. I feel like I'm bouncing back and forth with these questions.
That's
just because there's like a ton of them. We're running out of time.
That's all right.
But let's see here. This one's going to be a fun question. Are you proud of me?
More than you will ever know.
You didn't hesitate at all.
Yeah. I'm very proud of you because you, in spite of any struggles that we might have had, because that's part of growing up is having struggles. I know this, that God has gifted you uniquely to be strong and smart and kind and creative and spunky and opinionated and an independent thinker, and you love Jesus. And I know that God has a plan for you, and I know that if you can just grab a hold of that and don't give up, mm-hmm. that there's literally nothing you can't accomplish with your, with the struggles that you've had with your health, with your diabetes. That's a struggle every day, but you show courage and resolve and strength that I simply don't have. Mm-hmm. You're one of the strongest people that I know.
How?
You work through things. You find a way. Now, does that mean I don't want to kill you from time to time? No. I do. But you've not figured it out yet.
Yeah.
The light bulb hasn't gone off yet.
Oh.
And it will. I know it will. And you're going to, because whatever you do it with everything you've got. And if we can just, and your studies and your it's so important, your mom and I, that you get this degree so that you can have options with your life, so that you can have a life that's fruitful and productive and of service to other people, and a career that you can really sink your teeth into and really make a difference in the lives of other people. So am I proud of you? Yes, I'm very proud of you. But your best days are ahead.
Mm-hmm.
There's great things ahead for you, and I can't wait to sit back and watch that happen.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. That's really all the questions I have. There's a ton more, but I know us, we're long-winded.
That's okay. We got 8 more minutes left.
And we got 8 more minutes. Well, I'll ask this one then. Who has been the most important person in your life?
Well, I could give a lot of different people. There's a lot of different people that at different times in my life were there to love and support me and correct me and teach me. I mean, your mother is the most important person in my life.
Right.
That goes without saying. But in terms of the person probably that has been the most impactful on me becoming the person that I am, I would without hesitation say my mother.
Right.
I was a mama's boy.
Right.
Okay. My mother, before I was born, she had just lost her son and was very ill, and mentally, physically. And my mother, when she had me, she wasn't married, and she knew that my grandmother was grieving and my grandfather were grieving themselves to death, and my mother had the strength and the foresight to give me to them. And my mother always said that was the greatest gift that she could ever receive,
mm-hmm.
was another chance. And she would tell me from all the time, "You saved my life." And that's a lot of pressure on a kid.
Yeah, it is.
To hear that you were a gift from God, you saved my life. It's really hard to live up to that.
No kidding.
To be the golden child.
Right.
Okay. And
but you were. She told us that all the time.
She did. And that's a lot of pressure. But she and I were always so close. She would think something, and I would think the same thing. We had this like this bond, whether I was there in the house living or at college or wherever, married your mom. We were synced up, and one of my last jobs, I would drive 45 minutes to work, and we would talk every single day. And this was right toward the end of her life, and she would just, even at the very end, she was continually pouring herself into me, saying things like, "Now, when I die, don't be sad." Because my dad died when I was 22 years old when I lost my dad, which was way too young. Can you imagine that?
Yeah, no.
You're 21.
Yeah.
Imagine me gone, out of the picture.
No thanks.
Okay? So I didn't have anybody.
Mm-hmm.
During those early years of my adult life, I didn't have a dad. I didn't have anybody I could call. I didn't have anybody I could help. And so that's why my relationship with you is so important, is because I'm not going to leave you.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know how to do anything. And I didn't have anybody to call and say, Dad, how do I fix this? How do I work through this situation? I didn't have anybody. And so, but my mother, without a question, and my dad and I were super tight too, super close. But my mother and I were like, I really have surprised myself in how well I've done since you passed.
Mm-hmm.
I really, because I thought this several times. When mom passes, I won't live long. I won't survive this.
Mm-hmm.
But I did. Yeah. God's grace,
mm-hmm,
allowed me to get through that. But she and I were so close.
I know.
I miss her every day.
I know. I miss her too. Well, I think that's the end of our interview.
All right. Very good.
I told you it was going to be emotional.
That's okay. That's all right.
It's okay.
I've had fun.
Thank you for doing this with me.
You're very welcome.
Okay.